Oh, yes, my friends. It's the Sherwin Sleeve Show.
Take my hat, take my coat, take my gloves, I'll take a cup. Take my money, but I'm begging, please don't take my suit. Take my house, take my clothes, take my wife, lighten up my load. Take my feet, you can take my toes, but please don't take my zoo.
From the downtowniest part of New York City, the city that never sleeps, the city that never weeps, the city where nothing keeps. Coming to you live on WCJD 90.2, New York, high atop the Empire State Building.
Some point in the near future, I'm going to bop it up my way through an entire episode of The Radio Ghost. Just a long, long running chain of bop-a-da-bop-bops. And I just won't ever stop. I'll see who's there at the end, who hung with me to the bitter end of the bop-a-dops. I'm sort of overly focused on that, as young Christopher Budd asked who it was that was performing that song, where the song came from, who wrote it. The answer is mildly complicated. There's three answers. I think, first of all, that Fats Waller composed it. And second, the version I have, I don't know who is doing it. And third, I don't know if Chris is interested in the part that I sing or the part that comes after. When the gentleman starts singing on the night of June the 3rd, all that, that's the traditional song. What I sing at the beginning, I just made up. I was driving along one day listening to old music, perhaps even the Fats Waller bit, and I started, as I sometimes do, I started to sing along with it and made up my own lyrics and my own line. So there is no incarnation of the song except for the one that I do that has my, whatever I sing about, take my wife and have some coffee and please don't take my shoes. So there's no, as far as I know, no song called Please Don't Take My Shoes except this one. I'm riding the rail of someone else's song. This is ambient music too loud. Perhaps I should. I'm having an enormous critical failure with all of my equipment. It's a colossal failure that would, it can't rival the Titanic, because I'm not crashing into anything. But for example, my headphones are broken, so I'm relying on some terrible old pair that I can hardly hear anything through. It's a bit like a soup can on either ear with strings tied to it. Second, my microphone is also breaking. It does work from time to time, but then all of a sudden it sounds like it explodes and turns into a bird and then flies into a tiny hole. So if you do hear that, an explosion and then something turning into a bird and going into a hole, that's simply the microphone temporarily perishing. It will come back after a minute or two, or two, or three. Also, the audio device, the interface that goes between the microphone and the computer, is also dying. As is the computer, as am I. So all of us are really on the last of our last legs. We had all of us seven legs to begin with, and now we're on the last seventh leg. And obviously I'm not bitter about it. It's all right. It's nice to have soup cans on one's ear. It's nice to witness a piece of equipment turn into a bird and go down into a hole after explosions. So what shall we begin with tonight? We're going to... What did I tell you what we're going to do? And then you can decide whether you want to stay. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to listen to some trees, or one tree, at least. It's a bit of a sleight-of-hand trick. Almost conceptual art, but it's interesting in itself. I should have written his name down, but this, imagine someone from a faraway land with a very long name. That's who did this, and what they did was they created a record player that can read the information from a tree and convert it into music. So if you cut a section of tree, and imagine it looks exactly like a record, a perfect circle of wood that you could set on a record player. This record player's needle is a laser, and it examines the rings as they go around, and their thickness and their distance from each other, and various other pieces of information, and then converts that into music. Piano music. Some other percussionary sounds are in there. Now, it's a bit of a trick, and I'll talk about that a bit after I play it. Not a trick, but it's deceptive. Because obviously it is not the music of a tree. It is the music of a concept of a tree, or of a conversion of something a tree does into mathematics. But now I'm talking about it. The next thing we're going to do, there's a new piece of fiction. It's not new, but it's newly published in the recent New Yorker by Roberto Bolano, the Chilean novelist. It's called Labyrinth. And I've actually not completed the story. I've only read the first two pages. But it has an interesting premise, and I don't even know where it's going. But it is fiction. But when you, if you open the magazine and turn to the page, you see a large black and white picture that was taken perhaps in the 1970s of eight people sitting around a table. And it's a real photo, and he references all the characters in the photograph, but he goes on at length about this photograph and talks about all the different persons there, what they look like, what they're wearing. And I thought as a piece of fiction, referencing a piece of non-fiction and being very adhered to it, that it was a very interesting thing. And when I read some of the story, you'll be able to, if you're listening, watching on Ustream, I'll put up the picture and you'll be able to see it. A rarity for the radio ghost these days to have any image other than the radio ghost image. But I thought, well, why not? Why not a small little picture now and then? But if you're somewhere else, if you're in Canada, in that place that... Where is it? I can't remember. C-W-C-A-N-D-A-C-S. I don't know what it is. Why don't I write that down? Who's not helping me? Someone is not helping me. And perhaps it's me. But somewhere in Canada they listen. Or if you're listening on partyfmradio.net, where the fun will not ever stop, you also won't know about this picture, but you can go by the New Yorker and look at the picture and then read the story and do as I did, which is read a little bit and then look at the picture, read a bit, look at the picture. So that'll be the number two thing that we do, Roberto Bolano's Labyrinth. The third thing is rather short. We'll listen to three demo tracks that I sent to my friend Roy Harter. And we'll listen to the song that he took. He listened to these three demos. They're very brief, maybe 30 seconds each. Most of them don't have words, I don't think. Or not many words, and mostly it's a lot like the bap-a-dap at the beginning. But Roy picked one of the songs. Completely wrote it out as a fully arranged piece. And wrote the lyrics, and then I sang them. It was the easiest song I've ever worked on. And it could be the best produced, the best arranged. And in some ways, the most finished. I needed to take a breath there. I may need another breath. Let me have... Sometimes when I need to take a breath, I take a drink of tea. What does that mean? This doesn't go into my lungs. And this is, of course, Pol Pot's tea. In a Nuola Christ cup. Sorry, I pronounced your name wrong because in my mind I pronounced it wrong for so long I have to keep going with that. So we'll do the demos, the three demos that became one fair song, Bone Setter, and then we'll listen to the Kitteriembas chapter 13, The Dropsied Skin. That's about 35 or 40 minutes long in itself. So if you want to duck out after that, if that is not something you're pursuing or interested in, that's fine. But I'll come back at the end and we'll take some phone calls, perhaps. Now I feel like I've talked about all these things. I have to recharge myself. Why don't we go directly to Trees by the foreign named person from parts far away. We'll listen to the sound, the supposed sound, the ascribed sound of a tree. So this is and if you go online and you look up a tree, record player, far away person, long name, you'll be able to find this. And I'll post it on radioghost.com later as well, the video at least. So we'll listen to Trees for a moment and then we'll come back. Who knew that trees could get so angry? They start off very quietly and then they begin to rage, like any of us, I suppose. Now, recently, in the last number of years, it seems that there's been a lot of conversion of things into music. Anything that produces any kind of complicated, array of gatherable statistic can be turned into some form of music. So we can hear the stars, we can hear anything that doesn't naturally itself perhaps make any noise, or does make a noise, or but has other information. We could turn a storm or the patterns of the wind into music. All we have to do is come up with our criteria. I'm not at all complaining about turning a piece of wood into music or examining and coming up with a list of things about that wood. The distance between the rings, the thickness of the rings, how they rise and fall. Because the truth is, the more that you listen to that bit with the tree song, the more it does feel like a tree. But you have to get over the initial problem. And it's a poetic expression of a tree. It's a conversion. It's like an expressionist painting of a tree. And there's a quality to it that I struggle with because it's anthropomorphic. It's turning the tree into something it's not. It's as though we're saying, well, what would it be like if a tree wrote a novel? What would it be like if a tree did a painting? And then we assign the same type of valuation. The rings means this, and then a word would come out. It's like a random generator, but the random part is controlled by the tree itself. And that in itself is what grabs us, is that the tree, the information of the tree can be felt in a different way, that we could look at the rings and that means something, but it's very flat and doesn't come launching out of the wood at us. But to hear it, we move inside the tree. Or we can. If we can suspend our problem that it is not the tree. I should start the Skype here. Maybe I'll start that after. We'll turn the Skype on after the Kittery Embers. Why don't we move on to the Roberto Bolano? I'm going to put the image up on the screen now, so you can take a look. Maybe I'll turn the music down. Oh no, that's the beginning sound of the bird. The bird is going. I don't know if that's because I turned the ambient music down, the microphone got upset or lonely. Could convert that into my microphone. I could put that on the internet. The songs of my microphone. I'm going to make some snappy noises. Sometimes these snappy noises are like a team of medics that come in and do some audio surgery to the microphone. Oh, it sounds better. I'm going to turn this off. So this is Labyrinth by Roberto Bolano, and when I read this to myself earlier, I could feel that it was a story that was meant to be read quickly. I can't read it quickly, but it should be read quickly. It has a speed to it. It's a story that wears fast sneakers and it runs. But what I thought was most interesting about it was the fixity it has on this photograph. And as someone who writes, I was interested in the way that he grasped and grappled with the details of the photo and what he chose to render and what he chose to notice. And he chose to notice just about everything. Now, we're not going to read the whole thing, but here's some of it. Labyrinth. They're seated. They're looking at the camera. They are captioned from left to right. J. Henrique, J.J. Gou, P.H. Solis, J. Kristeva, M. T.H. Reveille, P. Guyatat, C. DeVade, and M. DeVade. There's no photo credit. They're sitting around a table. It's an ordinary table made of wood, perhaps, or plastic. It could even be a marble table on metal legs. But nothing could be less germane to my purpose than to give an exhaustive description of it. The table is a table that is large enough to seat the above-mentioned individuals, and it's in a cafe, or appears to be. Let's suppose for the moment that it's in a cafe. The eight people who appear in the photo, who are posing for the photo, are fanned out around one side of the table in a crescent, or a kind of opened-out horseshoe, so that each of them can be seen clearly and completely. In other words, no one is facing away from the camera. In front of them, or rather between them and the photographer, and this is slightly strange, there are three plants, a rhododendron, a ficus, and an everlasting, rising from a planter which may serve, but this is speculation, as a barrier between two distinct sections of the cafe. The photo was probably taken in 1977 or thereabouts. But let us return to the figures. On the left-hand side we have, as I said, J. Henrique, that is, the writer Jacques Henrique, born in 1938, and the author of Archer, Artaud Travail, Par la Chine, and Chasse. Henrique is a solidly built man, broad-shouldered, muscular-looking, probably not very tall. He's wearing a plaid shirt with the sleeves rolled halfway up his forearms. He's not what you would call a handsome man. He has the square face of a farmer or a construction worker, thick eyebrows, and a lower lip, slightly thicker than the upper. He's wearing a turtleneck sweater and a dark leather jacket. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped a paragraph. Let's go back to the construction worker. Thick eyebrows, and a dark chin. One of those chins which needs to be shaved twice a day, or so some people claim. His legs are crossed, and his hands are clasped over his knee. Next to him is J.J. Gou. About J.J. Gou, I know nothing. He's probably called Jean-Jacques, but in this story, for the sake of convenience, I'll continue to use his initials. J.J. is young and blonde. He's wearing glasses. There's nothing especially attractive about his features, although compared with Henrique, he looks not only more handsome, but also more intelligent. The line of his jaw is symmetrical, and his lips are full. The lower lip slightly thicker than the upper. He's wearing a turtleneck sweater and a dark leather jacket. I pause for a break, both to breathe in the tea and the air. Isn't this a peculiar thing to do, Roberto did? I think what strikes me is this is the sort of thing that I have done in some form before, but without any commitment. Something in a notebook, a way of sketching. I think writers and other artists might do this. You go out to a cafe, you see something, and you try to render it. As type of challenge. Perhaps you don't have anything to write about or to work on or to sketch, so you go somewhere, to a park, and you take down what you can, what you see. Let's continue. Beside J.J., who is the man second from the left in the glasses, beside J.J. is P.H. Solis, Philippe Solis, born in 1936, the editor of Tel Quel, author of Drame, Nombre, and Paradis. I apologize for my bad French. A public figure, that was me saying that, not Roberto. A public figure familiar to everyone. Solis has one arm crossed, the left arm resting on the surface of the table, the right arm resting on the left, and his right hand indolently cupping the elbow of his left arm. His face is round. It would be an exaggeration to say that it's the face of a fat man, but it probably will be in a few years' time. It's the face of a man who enjoys a good meal. An ironic, intelligent smile is hovering about his lips. His eyes, which are much livelier than those of Henrique or J.J., and smaller, too, remain fixed on the camera, and the bags underneath them help to give his round face a look that is at once preoccupied, perky, and playful. Like J.J., he's wearing a turtleneck sweater, though the sweater that Solas is wearing is white, dazzlingly white, while J.J.'s is probably yellow or light green. Over the sweater, Solas is wearing a garment that appears at first glance to be a dark-coloured leather jacket, though it could be made of a lighter material, possibly suede. He's the only one who's smoking. Beside Solas is J. Kristeva, Julia Kristeva, the Bulgarian semiologist, his wife. She is the author of La Traversée des Seines, Pouvoir de l'Horreur, and another book that I can't pronounce. She's slim, with prominent cheekbones, black hair parted in the middle and gathered into a bun at the back. Her eyes are dark and lively as those of Solas, although there are differences. In addition to being larger, they transmit a certain hospitable warmth, that is, a certain serenity, which is absent from her husband's eyes. She's wearing a turtleneck sweater, which is very close-fitting, although the collar is loose and a long V-shaped necklace that accentuates the form of her torso. At first glance, she could almost be Vietnamese, except that her breasts, it seems, are larger than those of the average Vietnamese woman. Hers is the only smile that allows us a glimpse of teeth. And before I exhaust myself and run my seventh leg into the ground, I'll stop there. Let us return the music. Now, the story is called Labyrinth. And it goes on for several more pages, and I don't know if it ever stops describing the figures in this photograph. And in some ways, I hope it does. After describing all the figures, perhaps it starts commenting on what they're doing here, or the relationships between them, where they might be hoping to go, their dreams and aspirations. I don't know. One of my first initial feelings when I began to read the story and saw that the photograph was, in fact, not just presented as a... Oftentimes with the New Yorker stories, they provide a fairly near image to suggest what the story is about. And if it's a story about a girl who goes into the ocean, there'll be a painting of a girl near the ocean. But they often use photographs. And so as I began to read the story, I thought the photograph was just simply a loose suggestion of what might be contained in the story. But then very quickly, I saw how exact it was, and that, in fact, the writer himself had been studying the photograph and rendering his text from it. And so one of my first thoughts when I realized that the photograph was directly taken, was a direct and needed part of the story, was what would it be like to read the story and not see the photograph? Or what did Roberto want for his reader? Did he hope that we would see the photograph and bounce back and forth between the text and the images? I wondered of his wishes. It almost seemed an invasion if he didn't want us to see it. Now, I don't know Roberto Bolano that well. I do know that he is a bit of a phenomenon, that he is deceased. He died in 2003. But he is considered something of a modern master, a genius, whose work will be studied far into the future. And I have not entered into his world yet. This is the first bit of him that I've ever read, although I've known of him for the last 5 years, I think. Peripherally. I was almost afraid of him, as I am afraid, perhaps, of certain works of James Joyce, that I would be getting in something that was too much to handle at that moment, that I didn't have the tanks and the armies to pull off such a reading. But I think after this story I may try one of his books. Of course, I don't have the Skype turned on, and I will turn it on at the end. If you want to talk about the Bolano or the tree, perhaps it'll be too late at that point, but I'm worried if I turn the Skype on now that I'll blow this whole circumstance. But we can talk about that later. But don't we move into the demos? So there are three short songs that I sent to Roy. I've sent Roy now perhaps six songs. One of them I played last week was It's Tired, I'm Late, and I'll play that at the end of the show tonight. And he took a dry lyric that I sang and wrote a song around it. So these demos, the first one, I don't think we're passing on, the second one I think we're passing on, but the third one is the demo for the Bones, what became the Bone Setter song. And you can hear that I did sing that one word, Bone Setter, quite clearly in the song. The rest of it is nonsense. So why don't we play these demos, and then maybe I'll play the song directly. I don't know what it will feel like. Maybe I have to talk about it. Let's listen to the demos first.
I'll take my own back to the wall. Let's sail away. Let's sail the wall. I'll take my hand. I'll take my way. I'll take more.
So Roy took that last bit, the piano bit, and just from 15 seconds, he wrote an entire song, added two new sections, an Irish jig and another section, and he wrote a whole story in lyric form. And what was most surprising for me was that the lyrics were very comfortable. It was the sort of lyrics that I would write. So it was personal. I read it and I thought, this feels like I wrote this. It was very strange. and very pleasing. So I'll play that song, Bonesetter Song, and unfortunately it's also in, or fortunately, it's also in chapter 13. It's one of the songs in chapter 13, so there'll be lots of Bonesetter during this episode, the 20th of the Radio Ghost. Here's what Roy Harter and his partner, Sean Berry, both of Skinny Man Studios. You can go to skinnyman.com and see some of their other work. Also, if you find Roy Harter, it's R-O-Y-H-A-R-T-R. Did I spell that right? H-A-R-T-E-R. Goodness. Seventh leg. You can find him on Facebook, that name, and Sean Barry, B-A-R-R-Y. They also have some very funny videos of each other trying to destroy the other with bombs and cars and rockets. But here's the Bonesetter song that Roy and Sean came up with, and I did so little in this, it doesn't feel like I even helped. And I must say, I feel a great sense of gratitude and warmth and thanks for this sudden musical relationship. It's very nice. It's hard to describe it, because I have an enormous amount of limitations when it comes to music. And Roy is, as far as I can tell, just deeply gifted in a deeply musical sense. And he plays all these bizarre instruments, theremin, and I can't even name them all. So anyway, I owe you a lot of thanks for that. So now, I wasn't prepared to do the Radio Ghost show this evening, and because I've been working on Chapter 13 of Kittery Embers and not thinking about what to do, and so early today it occurred to me that, well, I'm putting out these chapters every 2 weeks, perhaps. Instead of doing the Radio Ghost, I should talk for a moment and then play the chapter, and that could stand in as the episode. Now, I don't know if I'll do that or not, but that's what I'm doing this evening. Although we have gone for a while, and we could almost say that I don't have to do that, but why not? Now, in my sense of things with this chapter, if you're not paying attention to or reading or listening to Kittery Embers, then that's fine. You can listen to this or not, but I don't think I can summarize what's happened so far. But I think we're probably going to go to about 18 chapters and then it'll probably come to an end. Just for those of you who might be wondering if we're going to 1,000 chapters or 14 chapters, where are we in terms of the end? I think around chapter 18. So we're getting there. Now, as this is a work in progress, there will be things that perhaps don't make complete sense, that aren't, and also because it's a work in progress written in a particular way without a deep understanding of where I'm going. I don't have it all plotted out, I've mentioned that before. I tend to work to the end and then go back and fix. So there will be many things that I need to fix. Now, if you're listening to the story, or if you do read the story, and you have something you want to tell me, please do. I'm very receptive to critical impressions of all kinds. Even negative, it doesn't bother me. Not anymore, not really. Now, of course, I want people to like it, but if they don't like it, I generally tend to understand. So if the story is falling off for you, I would like to know, because I would like to fix it and make it the best possible thing it can be. And I no longer have the younger person's sense that I am solely in charge of this or anything that I do. I'm not. It's a lot like the collaboration with Roy. I can do one part, but I don't do the other part. And it works much better when there are other people assisting you. So for every novelist out there that becomes a great novelist, they have other people around them that are raising them up in very surprising and secret ways and making them sparkle in the way that they do. So I'm not saying that anyone needs to raise me up so that I may sparkle in the way that I might, but simply that my main interest is I would like the book to be clear and understandable, and I would like it to make sense and to be enjoyable. I came up with some slogan a while ago, I'm trying to remember it. I think I wanted it to be fun, entertaining, and meaningful. It seems terrible and trite and a poor ambition to want to be fun or entertaining and meaningful, but it meant something to me to think about it in that way. That I wanted to maintain those aspects. Not that fun and entertaining are much different, but at the time when I was sloganizing, they seemed remarkably different. Now that I've come up and said this slogan, I feel like I must rethink it. Then I have a better three. So, if you have thoughts about Kittery Embers, please let me know, and as these chapters come out, if it's working for you, let me know. If it's not working, I'd like to know that too, so that I can fix it, or so that I know it's working. I don't need flattery that it's the best thing in the universe or that it's the worst thing in the universe, but simply, yes, this is working, you're on the right track, because I don't know completely what I'm doing. I'm like the tree. I'm like both like the record player and I'm the tree, and it's I spin myself around inside my own contraption and some song comes out. But maybe my calculations are off and maybe I'm looking at the wrong information. At any rate, so you can write me at showandsleeves@yahoo.com or go to radioghost.com, post a comment, or find me on Facebook, Show and Sleeves, or Twitter, Show and Sleeves. I don't know how to say all that. So here it is, Chapter 13, The Rule Book and Calendar of Kittery Embers. And after it's done, I'll come back and I'll turn the Skype on. If you have any questions or wish to talk, that would be the time. All right, see you shortly, my friends.
My horse tired, I threw darts at balloons till I won. And I drank all the lemonade, drove bumper cars till it seemed like I owned the whole bar. And wherever I went, well, I shook every hand. I said, welcome to my wonderland. I said, welcome to our wonderland.
The Rule Book and Calendar of Kittery Embers. Chapter 13, The Dropsied Skin. Kittery stood upon her grandfather's back. There was a relieving smallness all through her now, a nearness of all things. The trees at the forest edge and the star frost brushed the surface of her eyes. The chilled wooden fragrance of the earth was dense and close. The airy wind ruffled the distant branches inside her head. In the glow of the white rain that wrapped her wrist, Kittery stared down at her grandfather's face. He was quiet now on the ground, sleeping on his belly, his face turned to a side. When she tried to step from his back, her feet swam into the earth. She walked along his legs, but it was the same all around. Her feet would not touch the ground. Her grandfather's body was like a tiny island in the center of an empty sea that she was stranded upon. She leaned over his face with a curious memory. There had been something like this from before. A memory from long ago, just like this, from before the time she'd moved to the swamp with her parents. It seemed impossible to her that she'd ever stood upon her grandfather, but the memory stretched through her body with the roots of recognition. He had been sleeping, just like this, and it was the first time she'd seen the family resemblance. Her mother's fine mouth and wide eyes revealed upon his otherwise turbulent face the downy touch of red in his silver hair, the upper lip like a skirt pinched to either side, and the gully of wrinkles departing the edge of his eyes. Kittery had the same crease developing, although infinitely softer. They had driven to her grandfather's house on the hill above the beach in the days before they'd moved to the swamp. A ship-like structure of pillars and porticos, with a dark livery of vines crawling over the white boards, like a fishing net, and a twisting level of windowed turrets and masts going back. The lawns and gardens rose in windy greens and greys, like a strange coloured sea. She was in the back seat of the car, pressed to the door by the jumble of luggage. Her father driving, her mother in the seat up front. "The house is very grand," her mother told her as they drove. "And he has a garden and many fruit trees and a staff." "He has a staff," her father echoed, glancing at the car's roof, his temporary way of seeing her. He used to be quite important, a minister of this or that. They drove together in the old black car, along a hammered road, and saw no other cars or trucks or houses. Kittery stared out the window and worried that she would miss the ocean because the field grass was so high she couldn't see anything but the flicker of chaff. Soon, she kept asking. Soon the sea? Her mother asked. Or soon grandfather's house? Soon the sea, she said. But the answer would be both. She would see them at the same moment. Her parents spoke of her grandfather and the ocean in similar tones and resemblances, as though they were nearly the same thing. The sea was vast and enigmatic, and you could hear it breathe. It was not the land, but held the land in place. When you saw the sea, you filled up with your life. You sensed the ocean in yourself, her mother told her, as though she should prepare for the sight of such a mirror. They described her grandfather in other terms of endlessness and mystery. A powerful man who had done great things. He not only ruled the land, but was the ruler of her blood. She came from him. She came from the ocean. She was going back to both, going back to where she came from. It seemed to Kittery, and was the promise of her excitement, that when she saw them both, the ocean and her grandfather, she would know what she meant and what the world meant in the same moment with the same answer. Her grandfather, the ocean, the stars, the footsteps of flesh and blood and sea and light that lapped backwards through time. Her sack of toys was shoved in the space behind her father's seat. Crayons and coloured pencils stuck out like odd hair from the top. Her favourite bean-filled animal and her new diary were unreachably buried at the bottom. "While we're away," her mother said, "you could write down everything that happens and draw pictures. When you visit me, you can bring your book and read to me the things you've done and seen. I've written little messages inside as well, one for each day. But don't read them all at once. It'll be like a vacation," Mr. Embers said, suddenly but quietly, glancing at the ceiling. And then her mother turned around in the front seat, as she always did when she needed to tell her something important. "This is serious, Kittery," her mother said. "We would never go to grandfather's otherwise. We would never leave you like that unless we had to, and we do. Your father will have to spend a lot of his time with me." "Short trip away," her father corrected. "And you'll be nestled in with the old minister, everything taken care of, full staff, run of the place, breakfast in bed, Kittery. You have your very own room with a stupendous view and a desk and table. You'll have the gardens, the sea. There's a beautiful beach. You could walk there every day." Mrs. Embers leaned in closer. "It's not that I don't want you to be with me, Kittery, because I do. Some things need time and quietness, and I'll need many moments to myself to get better, and your father and I will need to talk and settle things." Mrs. Embers scooped a hand over Kittery's cheek and held it, smiling. Both her parents beamed, as though this separation might be considered fine news from the perspective of adventure. "This is because you're still tired?" Kittery asked. "It is," her mother said. "We can't have your mother in bed all the time," Mr. Embers said cheerfully. "We need her up and about, dancing and singing and telling us what to do. Otherwise, how would we ever know when it's time for lunch or bed? Who will say what clothes to wear or books to read or what fun things to do in the evening? Not me." Kittery smiled at this, not because she was happy, but because they needed her permission. "And I'll be back as often as I can," her father finished. "It's not really such a bad drive. And what country! I'll enjoy going back and forth. No other cars and this old cracked-up road. Just this beautiful land. And going to visit my daughter in a grand house by the sea. Exactly what I'll need. Just try to stop me." Kittery tried to remember a time before this. before the long drive to grandfather's, before her weeks and months in the house by the sea. But her life began in the black car on the Hammond Road. Her mother had given her the knit yellow yarn bag to bring along whatever she liked. She'd filled it to the soft handles with stuffed animals, her dearest friends. But then how would she draw her pictures? She took everything out and put in the new diary book tied with a string, and a pencil case and a hand sharpener. And then her father had suddenly begun to fill her yellow bag himself with overflow. A great pair of boots, a zippered box from the bathroom, her slippers in beside her toothpaste and hairbrush, until there was hardly any room for animals. A small one, perhaps, her father said, gazing at the mound of puffy creatures on her bed. Dossie, Kittery said. That's who I'd take, he answered. And so she'd grabbed the old bean-filled mouse, with his black eyes glued to the wrong places, and his few remaining whiskers bald at the ends from melting near the fire, and she pushed him in alongside her boots. They drove up and down the troughs and kettles of the hills, and then rose past a small, perfectly circular pond. She rolled down the window when the roof of the house came into view. The sea is on the far side of the hills, her mother said. It will be there suddenly, so don't even blink. And there came a moment where Kittery could tell, from the dropped absence in the sky, that something mighty filled the space beyond the cuts of land. The huge driveway bushes were pruned in neat shapes, green torpedoes and cannonballs, and the grass was of a peculiar yellow lightness, as though the ocean air were killing it. And just as they pulled into the cinder circle before the house, Kittery kneeled on her seat and pressed her face out the window to inhale the grain of the sea. The ocean breathed in a thousand places in the air, growing louder until she saw it. A great steely face, packed with jagged eyes. The ocean held itself for a moment between a crack of hill and sky, and then was gone a moment before the car came to a stop. After lunch, her mother said, we will all go down to the water, and then your father and I will be off. He'll be back in a week, 7 days, and you can mark those days on the calendar in your diary. Kittery had never before met her grandfather, a grey stranger in a wheelchair on the shadowed porch. He used to be quite something, her mother said, but now he's in that chair, and he can do very little. And there will always be plenty of people around, gardeners and nurses and staff. He can hardly move now, and is very old and quite finished as far as anything. As sad as that is, that's why it's good for us now, safe for you, completely safe. As Kittery looked at the wooden circles of his wheelchair and the heavy blanket on his lap, she saw her grandfather raise a crooked arm and sniff the air. He's waving, she reported, but was he? She waved back to see if she could make his arm swing toward her, but he simply lowered the thin limb and looked away. One day she would be an old woman on a porch in a chair like that. Her mother used a chair at home, and her grandfather did. And if they all had the same blood and came from the same ocean, wouldn't they all end up in the same chair? Here I am, her grandfather announced, as though it was he himself who had just arrived. She stared at her feet and slid them down into the cinders. Her father leapt around the car to fetch the wheelchair from the trunk as an old nurse in a dark uniform glided from the house. Her grandfather was trying to stand. The blanket dropped from his lap. The nurse took him firmly by the shoulders and pushed him down into his chair. But he battled her back with slapping hands, and finally ceased. "Who is that?" Kittery asked. "That is your grandfather's nurse," Mr. Embers said. "She lives in the house, in a room beside his, but I don't remember her name. You'll be on the top floor, though, way above them." Her father pointed to a glassy square, enclosed in vines, and smiled at the delightful distance. "I think her name is Biscuits," Mrs. Embers said, settling into her chair, unlocking the brakes. "It's Mrs. Biscuits." And then another man emerged from the house in a fine suit. He stood in a formal position, arms staunchly behind his back, as though he would always be present to observe the difficult work he somehow couldn't do. "That's Mr. Twidbin, your grandfather's secretary," her father said. "And it's Brussels," Mrs. Embers said, as her father began to push her over the stones. "I'm sorry, not Biscuit. It's Mrs. Brussels."
"I've been wondering if the way I'm pondering is the way I make my way back home. Since I've taken all this time, I've wasted all this time just making my way home. Hold down steady, there's a hold down ready, there's a hold down ready, that's a home. Hold down steady, there's a hold down ready, there's a hold down ready, that's a home. I've been wondering if the way I'm pondering is the way I make my way back home. Since I've taken all this time, I've wasted all this time just making my way home. Hold down steady, there's a hold down ready, there's a hold down ready, that's a home. Hold down steady, there's a hold down ready, there's a hold down ready, that's a home. I've been wondering if the way I'm pondering is the way I make my way back home. Since I've taken all this time, I've wasted all this time just making my way home.
It certainly was a gloomy room, with all its dripping dark rocks, but Darcy was nevertheless quite pleased to see it. He felt as though his eyes had been turned off for a very long time. Through the stony walls he could hear a creeping rumble, either the howling wind or the groaning of dirt, it was hard to tell, which meant they were either in the tipsy top of a castle turret or deep below the ground. He looked at the peculiar worm around his neck and then upward at the woodpecker above him. Both were sound asleep. Despite this, the great woodpecker maintained a firm grasp on Darcy's neck scruff and held him, very thankfully in fact, above an unpleasant reddish pool. Once again, it was a situation of complete questions and not a single answer. All by himself, Darcy had never stumbled across the exotic creation of an answer. Follow-up thoughts and expressions that began with, therefore, just didn't come naturally. Darcy surveyed the room. The bird's free leg was stiffly placed on the corner of a candlelit table. There were two books on the table. Therefore, he said, hoping to burst into theory. But only silent brain noises followed, little squishy cracklings of damp tinder that would never catch fire because there was no spark and because the tinder was never not wet. but he'd certainly slept long enough, hadn't he? His leaky brain boat should be in prime form, and capable of at least a minor notion or two. "I am going to have a thought," Dorsey thought to himself, not sure if this determination in itself might qualify as such a thing. For example, the poor greenish light. That was easy. The stub of candle was sputtering above the table for a reason. Its wick was so low and spent that all it could do was jostle the room with an on-and-off glow. Therefore, Dorsey concluded with a little shiver, it may soon be dark in here, completely dark. That was very nearly a thought, wasn't it? On the table lay two nearly identical books. Therefore, Dorsey said, praying again for liftoff, at the very least, he knew he'd seen the books before, been interested in them. But not both. Wasn't that it? In fact, there shouldn't be two of them, should there? That was a thought. That was a very clear, very apt conclusion, and Dorsey smiled at his lack of leaks. Both books were open, easily seen from his on the table, over the puddle, under the bird dangle. Yet every fuzzy word on the visible pages was a reminder that as far as reading was concerned, he might as well be the old worm around his neck, blind from sleep and a thorough lack of eyes. He froze when he saw them, knowing only they were his enemy. Upon the surface of the red liquid floated four treacherous ducks. "I know you," Dorsey told them grandly, very pleased to remember the high level of his animosity. "You are all on sticks and wooden as well, and I am very much on to you," Dorsey warned them. Also in the bloody awfulness there seemed to be a long, deflated heap of wrinkles, like a saggy old balloon wrapped in rags. "I thought I saw the mouse move," a wet voice called, suddenly from the vaporous dark of the hall. Dorsey froze as two figures stepped into view, a little girl and an older woman. "Never mind the mouse," the little girl said. She wore a yellow dress and had a rusted crown upon her reddish hair. They came closer and closer and stood right beside him, and Dorsey felt every tiny tip of his fur quiver with the terribleness. "Help me with the trimus, Mrs. Precious," the girl said, and gazed down at the blurry pages of the two books. The older woman, with slick wet lips and eyes like poisoned eggs, lifted the collection of creatures and set them regally down on the girl's shoulder. Dorsey almost exploded as the sleeping woodpecker's claws gouged a dripping wound into the girl's shoulder. But the girl herself sighed with relief as though approving the violence. There was a long pause as she examined the pages before her. Dorsey took the opportunity to observe the blood dripping from her shoulder directly into the puddle with the horrifying confirmation of no difference. The blood that dripped was the same as what it dripped in. Therefore, Dorsey reasoned, it is her blood. "Has the minister stumbled again?" the old woman asked, with a note of eagerness as though she hoped he had. "He has done what we needed, but it looks as though she has broken the glass of the ninth ven." Mrs. Brushes stiffened. "What power did she take?" "If she'd known anything about it," the little girl began, "she might have chosen wiser, but she has taken for herself the power of absolution." "The power of absolution?" Mrs. Brushes said, almost laughing. "In the moment of her transcendence, she must have had the very poor timing to forgive her grandfather." The little girl with the rusty crown laughed. "Did she?" Mrs. Brushes marvelled. "And thus," the monarch said, "Kittery Embers now wields the power of the grass. Mind you, I'm sure the minister is suffering now in the grassy blade of her compassions." The monarch turned slowly, kicking at the baggy, half-submerged form in the puddle. "When you removed my skin and placed me in her body, Mrs. Brushes, I thought we'd come to a certain end, the battle won. I was rejuvenated, young again, a whole new fresh life to command. I look down upon my old skin, floating in this pool, and I feel no connection to it. And then, too, how could she return? She'd been rebuffed to the littoral and Tamerlane, with no way of arriving here. But her rule is clear. The monarch leaned over the page and read Kittery's rule aloud. To find out deepest what's within, wear your oldest, last, and dropsied skin. She will come for the dropsied skin, Mrs. Brushes said, her mouth falling wetly open. She will come for the dropsied skin, Mrs. Brushes. She will try to escape Tamerlane and set my skin upon her sylvan frame, that she may walk amongst us once more. But we shall keep her where she is. She will never leave the woods of Tamerlane. She will remain as she is, the ghost of a girl. And we shall follow the instructions of my rule. And the monarch shifted across the table and gazed down at her own rule and read it aloud to Mrs. Brushes. Though three of us entwined and grossed, the one who lives must kill its ghost. To Tamerlane, then, Mrs. Brushes said, and finish the job for good. She lifted the Trimus Picus Vermis and set it back on the table edge. Dossie watched as the old woman and the little girl waded into the deeper pool and casually reached out for the pair of wooden ducks that paddled toward them, beaks snapping. Two spouts of blood shot into the air as the ducks took them down into the pool. Dossie didn't know what or why, only that something must be done, and now. But what? If his leaky brain boat couldn't provide the answer, there was something else that could. Whiskers! Dossie shouted to his whiskers. What is the something that must be done? For an endless moment, his whiskers wilted, but then his small feet began to fidget and twitch, and his little legs began to swing. What are you doing, Whiskers? He asked them, but they had streamed down alongside his face, quite busy with their plan, and soon his legs were pumping wildly, back and forth, and the great bird began to wobble above him. In the early wobbling, Dossie had the faint impression that his whiskers were trying to free him from the clutches of the bird, but as the wobble got wobblier and became a very precipitous rocking, Dossie understood. He took a gasping breath as the great woodpecker tipped off the table and splashed into the pool of blood below. Instantly, Dossie felt the bird's claw release him. There was a wave-making rustle of wings. With one paw, Dossie held tight to Unwith. The worm stiffened at the startling thick cold of the liquid. The moment the worm awoke, Dossie's mind flooded to the brim with several levels of understanding. It's all right, Mr. Unwith, he said, in a confident tone that he hoped might calm the shivering worm. He scrambled his tail for the saggy balloon, and then crawled across its sinking, baggy softness. Let the duck take you, Wizzywig, Dossie ordered. We're going back to Meadowlark. The bird's stunned face was drenched in puddle blood, but he stopped flapping away from the duck assaulting at his wings. Another curling emission of blood erupted as duck and woodpecker went shooting down into the blood. Dossie closed his eyes and stretched out a reluctant paw, as he'd seen the little girl and old woman do. Am I awake? Unwith cried out, struggling to emerge from his wormy fog of sleep. We are travelling now to Meadowlark, Dossie whispered. By duck, Mr. Unwith. The duck clamped its beak around his paw, and he felt a sharp tug. And just as they began their downward voyage into the heavy murk, Dossie stabbed his claws into the saggy skin beneath him. He didn't know why, but his whiskers did, that Kittery Embers would need it, would need the dropsied skin.
Ever desperate wandering in the wind, all the
abolish every soldier's sins. Bone setter ties stone belt around their wings. Hey, bone setter, bring your plunder back, become the king. They did not go down to see the ocean. The way was too rocky for her mother's chair, and the wind too fast and frigid from the beach. Instead, they stood in a line of three on the promontory and gazed down at the crashing waves until a lone bell called them back to the house for lunch. When her parents had finally driven off, Kittery was permitted a long moment to acquaint herself with the house. After leaving her things in her new room, with its high bed and lace covers, Kittery made her way along the carpets and back halls of the mansion, with Mrs. Brushes following close behind. Even in the bright twilight of the early afternoon, the house was dark. There was a sound of leaking air from the nearby ocean that penetrated every wall. Muffled chimes rang from rooms that could not be entered. Doors were locked, and lights were dimmed. Mrs. Brushes said very little during the tour, except to remark on things which could not be done or things that should not be changed. Several times, as Kittery turned the iron knob of a heavy hall door, Mrs. Brushes pulled her roughly back, saying, "The rooms that are locked cannot be entered." In the library, where the severe dark prevented the reading of even the largest book title, Kittery searched for and found a rheostat. But Mrs. Brushes grabbed her hand before she could turn it. "The lights are to remain set at the quarter mark," she said. That first night, Kittery sat with her grandfather before a small television. They ate a ham dinner from tin trays. Mrs. Brushes laid a starched napkin over her lap, and she was told to remain in her seat until her food was gone and the tray removed. Periodically, her grandfather would change the channel or decrease the volume from a controller mounted on the side of his wheelchair until they were watching a soundless blur of film in black and white. "It wasn't an easy birth," he said, wiping his chin with his thumb and wrist. It was the first thing he'd said to her all day. In fact, it was the first thing he'd ever said to her. "She was in bed for most of the pregnancy. Did you know that? Kittery did not. Locked in the prison of her tin tray and napkin, she looked into the darkness of the kitchen for some sign of Mrs. Brush's. She's my only daughter, and so I'm quite familiar with the details, and I may be forgiven my anger, the minister said. It is a situation of recurring hemorrhage and infection. Septicemia is what they call it. Quite curiously, I battle it myself, though with greater success. The liability is in our blood, Kittery, so you might remember the term. She nearly died when you arrived. I'm certain they would never tell you this, but you should know it. Know who you are and how you arrived. There's no good pretending otherwise. Like a bomb, you were exploded inside her. The old man turned his body from the flickering white film, a glued mass of bones. And there's not been a moment since of the bleeding, he continued. I nearly killed my own mother in the same fashion. All these recurrences and returns. Facts of our blood, Kittery. What happened to me will happen to you. You will one day live in this house and have what I have and do what I did. Whether you care to believe it or not, your footsteps have each one been taken for you. The world, the ocean, shall be yours as it was for me. One day nurses will push you down into your chair, though you can still stand. Look into my face and see yourself. The same eyes and mouth, the same skin. He reached a hand through the darkness, like a dead snake from a hole in the wall, and his fingers bit down into her shoulder like poison fangs. The same blood, the same flesh, he said, sinking his fingers deeper. Who did it? He inquired of the air, as though a universal question that anyone could ask. Who did it, Kittery, is what I aim to remind you of. What have you done to your mother, to my daughter, to me, then, and to your father? She could not breathe in the weight of it. All of it locked her in place, the tin tray and napkin, and the burden of his poisoned hand, and the rearrangement of the damage to her mother, from the mystery of the outside world, directly to her own body. Who did it? He asked again, without even trying, who did it? He loomed closer, and to make him stop, because his way was never to stop, she said it. I did, she whispered. He smiled to one side, and she felt his flesh wash over her, a dropping of heavy cold skin. We both did, he hissed in her ear. Just imagine what terrible things you could do if you put your mind to it. She raised her arms against the skin that fell, but her eyes were elsewhere and her strength was gone. There was a white glowing rain above her grandfather's face and the dark line of the forest and the pining frost of the stars. The woodpecker flew in over the trees, an exhausted contraption of feathers and fur, and found her where she stood upon his back. Her arms were raised in the dream of her resistance as Dossie set the saggy skin over her hands. It slid down her length with rippling acceptance, her brand new, her most old, outfit. With a cavernous and croaking voice, she called out the rule as it appeared in her mind. To find out deepest what's within, wear your oldest glass. And drops its skin. I walk down the path through the woods, the falling snow, my neighborhood, black as ice, a silver dream. We go skating down the stream. From high above, a blown frame, so we are back. Once again, show within a show type of a show. Now, I don't know if I'll ever do that again, play a chapter from Kittery Embers. I do like to keep them separate in some way. But there is a certain level of work that goes on to doing these Radio Ghost programs, and when I'm busy trying to finish the Kittery Embers chapter, I find myself colliding with interests and desires and wants and time, not having enough time to devote to this show while trying to finish that. I suppose doing it, putting that chapter in, it doesn't necessarily feel absolutely the right thing to do. But we'll see. I mean, maybe if we don't talk at all and just put it, that's something. I'm thinking out loud in the air. I suppose that's all I ever do. Juggle myself around and forward. And now let me start up the Skype here, and if anyone wants to call, that's fine. If not, I'll see if there's anything else I can think of. Where is it? I have to turn this music off for the Skype, but it doesn't seem to work. I'll turn that off and the Skype on. Now in this new New York, there's also, I don't know what it would be called, it's sort of a poetic reminiscence by the poet Donald Hall. And everything that I read about Donald Hall always, whether he's written it or someone else has written it, it always includes references to his wife, Jane Kenyon. They're both poets. They're both, well, well-regarded poets. Jane died, I think, in the 90s. And it was a crushing experience for Donald Hall, a very shaping experience for him. And many of his poems seem to relate to her death. And much of his writing seems to surround it. So his news piece, let's see if I can find it here. You know, actually, there was a poem that I... Let me see if I can find this poem first. It's not by Donald Hall, but I quite liked it near the end. This is the sound of me flipping pages. Here's a poem by Don Patterson. It's called Here. Don't like that. That's the sound of Skype wanting. If you do call in the middle of the poem, that's all right. So here it is, very short, by Don Patterson. It's with one T, P-A-T-E-R-S-O-N. And the poem is called Here. I must quit sleeping in the afternoon. I do it for my heart, but all too soon, my heart has called it off. It does not love me. If it down tools, there'd soon be nothing of me. Its hammer beat says, you are, not I am. It prints me off here like a telegram. What do I say? How can the lonely word know who has sent it out or who has heard? Long years since I came round in her womb, enough myself to know I was not at home. My dear sea up in arms at that wrong shore, and her loud heart like a landlord at the door. Where are we now? What misdemeanor sealed my transfer, mother? Why so far afield? Good job, Don. Don Patterson, not Donald Hall. One thing I was thinking as I read the Donald Hall piece, which is called Out the Window, and it's fairly descriptive. Reminiscence, or what would it be? It's in this personal history section, they call it. But he talks about the birds out his window, or they alight on the feeder, and the barn that he always sees. And then he goes into a bit of recollection about his wife, and about aging, and about death. And there are many things that I like about it, and then there are some things about it that I wonder. It's almost something I need to write about rather than talk about, because it's complicated and I might sound rather sharp, but I don't want to sound sharp about Donald Hall. But as I read it, there seemed to be an almost fetish quality to the writing, of things too closely observed. And it's a strange thing, because we want writers to observe, and we want them to write and to render, and all of that is done quite well. And he is a very good prose writer, and he does separate his prose person from his poetic person, and he uses his skills as a poet and his prose, but they don't really collide, and one doesn't feel like one's reading something that could otherwise be a poem. It stands as itself as prose. But there's something about his observations which are too close, too finely observed, as though they aren't actually what anyone can observe. And that might seem odd, but I suppose it's what it feels as though it's not true, that these are not true observations because they don't fairly capture the spirit of the observer. They capture instead the spirit of someone who is observing so that they may render, if you know what I mean. It is too fine. It is too photographic. Not that it is photographic, but almost too finely wrought. And that seems like it might connect up to his poetic side. And perhaps it does, but I think it's more a style of writing, a style of closely observed writing where very minute detail is seen and then rendered and brought forth in a kind of march of observations. I could read some of it, I suppose. Today it is January, mid-month, midday, in mid-New Hampshire. I sit in my blue armchair, looking out the window. I am 83. I teeter when I walk. I no longer drive. I look out the window. Snow started before I woke, and by now it looks to be 10 inches. They say we might have a foot and a half. There are three windows beside me where I sit, the middle one deep and wide. Outside is a narrow porch that provides shade in the summer. In winter, a barrier against drifts. I look at the barn 40 yards away, which appears to heave like a frigate in a gale. I watch birds come to my feeder, hanging from clapboard in my line of sight. All winter, juncos and chickadees take nourishment here. When snow is as thick as today, the feeder bends under the weight of a dozen birds at once. They swerve from their tree perches, peck, and fly back to bare branches. Prettily they light, snap beaks into seed, and burst away. Nuthatches, evening grosbeaks, American goldfinches, sparrows. Now I don't have any right to complain. And it's not... I may not even be specifically complaining about Donald Hall or his writing, but perhaps there was something in his writing somewhere that reminded me of something else in other writing that perhaps my own even, that I'm trying to stay away from or be aware of. Perhaps that's it. Who knows? Well, we've gone very long. It is 10:37. On my clock here, Wednesday night. What is the date? January 25th. And what shall we say? We shall say good night. We shall say always merry and bright. It's time I'm leaving your frozen fire. Turn out the lane. Tomorrow we'll sleep. through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sleep. It's tired, I'm late. Untie your candles, well, I just lit the skates. We're sleeping in sleepless light, count dreams till we're sleeping right. But now it's time to sleep.
Hit a ball now. Yeah, I told you about all them dreams I had. Now I lay down in the sea. Hear the moonlight in the time. I just don't get a surprise. Up to sleep.
It's tired, I'm late. Your frozen fire, turn out the light. Tomorrow we'll sleep through town, side every turn up, thing down. But now it's time to sleep.